Salutations and shit, folks. Welcome back to another episode of your favorite travel podcast, Travel and Shit, where I, your host, D. Carey, have an experiential conversation about the nuanced ways that travel intersects with regular life. And as I like to let y'all know, whenever I am joined by another beautiful face, the podcast is available on the YouTubes. Y'all don't have to just listen to this voice I had to grow into loving. Y'all, I used to hate the way I sounded recorded. Like, to the point where, like, I left that music on the voicemail, if you know, you know, for years, just because I didn't want to say nothing. But as I like to remind y'all, the faces, we are on the YouTubes. Another option for you to listen to the podcast and also to watch. And so joining me this week, my beautiful guest, please introduce yourself and welcome.
Thank you so much, Dee. My name is Kara Stevens, and I'm founder of The Frugal Feminista, which is an online financial platform really committed to helping Black women and their allies heal their relationship with money. Because when you heal your relationship with money, you're then able to clear the clutter in order for you to actually grow wealth and keep the wealth and enjoy the wealth.
Okay. So why finances? What was your journey like that got you into finances? Were you always a financial person? Do you work in like financial industry? Like, what was it about finances that became the it thing for you?
Well, the truth is I was in student loan debt after I graduated from college, and I wasn't trying to pay it back. And they kept on reaching out to me. And I thought that if I ghosted them, they would get the hint that I wasn't trying to pay it back. And clearly that's not how the world works. And so the balances kept on going up. My credit score kept going down. And so I had to figure out what they wanted, you know, and how much they wanted back.
They want their money, girl.
Right, but I really didn't know, honestly. So that's how I actually started. And so I remember being in my mom's, the front of the house, the foyer, and opening up the bill and kind of trying to have her commiserate with me, talking about, Mom, do you believe that they're asking me for this money? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, oh. And she's like, you know, you got to pay it back. And I was like, really? And so that was the journey. And so I went to the library shortly after and found a book by Glenda Bridgeforth called Girl, Get Your Money Straight. And I was like, wow, even when I went to the library, I was like, you got money about books? I mean, books about money? And they were like, yeah, over in the personal finance section. And I was like, wow, there's a whole section that I knew nothing about. And the irony was that I studied economics and political science in undergrad, but I didn't know much about personal finance. I knew about world political economies, but I didn't know anything about personal finances. And then, so that's how it started. It started as a blog spot, basically asking my girlfriends, did you know you had to pay this money back? Because I know I didn't. So, you know, let me share my journey with you. That plus being single. I'm not sure if your community is familiar with A Different World, but I was a different world girl, and I was expecting my whole Dwayne and Whitley situation, and I had none of that. I had no job, no partner, no prospects. This was right after September 11th, and so I was like, all this and debt? No. I want my money back.
Yeah.
And so that's how it started, honestly. It was just me just figuring out and sharing with my friends that you got to pay the money back. I didn't know. Now you know. I just was just sharing and sharing.
So question, what was your like personal, I guess more familial experience is a better idea, because that is so like, I never considered that someone wouldn't consider that they had to pay it back. And it's a very fair point. Like you don't, not everybody has that same realm of information to pull from. So what was your like, your understanding of finances growing up? Did your parents like give you an allowance and tell you to save? Or did you end up having to work as a younger person? Did you have to work through school? Like what was your early relationship with money before adults you had to actually navigate it a little bit differently?
Well, my relationship with money was very much positioned and followed my mother's relationship with money. And her relationship with money, at least when I was growing up, was very much rooted in a space of scarcity and fear around money, that there was never enough money. there was a resentment around having to pay things back or things being too expensive. So I can see how that trickled into me not wanting to pay back the loan, but not really being aware of the workings of loans and what they meant is definitely a reflection of my childhood, because in general, when money was talked about, it was more talked about in there's not enough, or keep it away from your families, or don't trust men with money, don't trust family members with money. It was more of the emotional components and more of the things that needed to be hidden, or money was something that was a taboo topic in the sense of it created drama in the family, so we tried to avoid it. Or in the sense of my mom, my father having left us, money was a soft spot in terms of not wanting to ask for too much. Mm-hmm. And the only way that money was really not celebrated, but it was seen as a useful tool, was for investing in education. So Okay. You can understand my mom's kind of like, of course you got to pay it back because it's worthwhile. But in other areas of your life, you know, everything should be the cheapest, or if someone's trying to ask you to pay full price, then it's almost like they're trying to talk about your mother. You know what I mean? Because it was something that was disrespectful to do, you know, and something to be avoided.
Okay. Do you think that that was like a personal thing, or is that a cultural thing? I don't know if that's something, I don't know what culture or how you identify, like, would you say that there is a connection in that at all?
Yeah, I would say there's a definite connection. My family, I'm first generation American from Antigua, okay. From the Caribbean, and it's just not Caribbean people. It's a lot of first generation Americans from other countries. I would say a lot of South Asian friends have said the same thing. Asian friends, even African friends on the continent, just this idea of having to hoard and pinch and hold on to money, and that spending money outside of education was considered frivolous or looked down upon. And that coupled as a woman who was now unpartnered created even like a demotion in status that my father was a doctor. So that's even a bigger drop in status, that not only is she unmarried, she's raising two kids by herself, but now she's no longer a doctor's wife. And so I think that coupled with the cultural piece, coupled with the actual individual circumstances, definitely created that, passed down that belief system. Plus, I was also a girl and I was the youngest. So my mom was kind of molding me to protect me, I guess, in her way from what she thought would be an inevitable part of being a Black woman when it came to love, and also in America when it came to just having to survive racism and sexism.
And to be clear, if y'all haven't picked up on it yet, we're having this conversation about money because for the majority of us, the travels don't come for free. Of course, the girlies are getting, you know, influencer trips or the vacations or family trips. Like, there are plenty of ways to travel for the free. Go y'all. However, for the rest of us, we have to pay for it. And somewhat like you said, I guess your mom imparted that wisdom, that education was very much so something that was worth the cost. But a lot of people don't necessarily think that travel is worth the cost. Mm-hmm. I know that for me, one of the things I used to hear in the back of my head was, well, I hope you're saving your money. You doing all this run around, you doing all this travel. Like, what's your house look like? What's this look like? Like, you good for this? Or I hope you better not ask me for nothing, or not enough. So it's just like, on the one hand, it's, you have people that will encourage, you know, your money to be spent on what they think is a good idea or what they think is of value. But at the bigly adult spaces that many of us, I assume my listeners are all adults. First of all, hey to my nieces. Hey, Taylor. Hey, Tahila. Hey, babies. I know y'all like short attention span for the kids, but I was talking to my best friend. And she was like, yeah, we listen. I'm like, hey, y'all. So hey to my babies. Hey, Dom. You too, girl. So there are different realms of the world, different pockets where people will assign value to what should be spent on and how much one should spend on. And our own personal relationship with those finances often will influence that. And those influences come from family, friends, and from the places outside. But once you are in your own financial situation, you are the one responsible for building it, cleaning it, fixing it, solidifying it, all those things in between. So we kind of see how, you know, the financial decision or the decision to be concerned with finances started for you. What was your first step after you realized that your credit score wasn't going to get any better and that you actually needed that for some, you know, for some interactions with life and that those student loans weren't going to go anywhere? What was your next step? What did the personal finance section at that library, and I'm a library baby, I used to love going to the library, so shout out to our libraries, but what did that personal finance section put you onto?
Well, I mean, it actually put me on to Black authors that talked about money, and that was really important for me. Honestly, the Glenda Bridgeforth book was one of the only books in the library that was on personal finance, and I almost felt it was like divine that it was right there waiting for me to pick it up, because that was my first book into the world of personal finance. And then from there, I started to look for other OGs, Black women in personal finance. So then I started looking up Lynette Calfani, Michelle Singletary. Those are like OGs like 15, 20 years ago, and they're still there. And so that speaks to the importance of representation, one. And then two, the importance of immersing yourself. That's just not one book. So as I started to take notes on that first book, and I started to implement the things in the first book. So everything that comes with knowledge has to come and has to be followed with action. So once I got filled or couldn't find any more Black female authors in personal finance, I started listening to white boys. But my first step was to like take the learnings and the advice and the supports from those books and actually implement them. So from Lynette Calfani, she had a couple of books around getting out of debt. So I started to build like a debt elimination plan. From Michelle Singletary, who talked about Big Mama. And she also back in the day had a show on TV One, which was called Singletary Says. And I used to get up on Sunday morning and watch. It was basically a reality show for people with trouble with their personal finances. I used to watch it religiously. And so from her, I learned that there's no such thing as discretionary spending. And I've loosened up that belief system. It's a little bit too tight for me, but it helped me learn how to save. So from Michelle, I learned how to save and pay in cash. From Lynette, I believe I learned how to get out of debt. And from Glenda, I learned what it means to be a Black woman and our relationship with, you know, status, how things look, how people feel about what we're doing, and some of the pressures that many of us may have to overcome to stop spending for status or to stop spending so people will approve of us. And so I started to rethink my relationship with so many different parts of my life vis-a-vis these books. And I started to peel away at some of the ideas that I might have had about money based on my childhood. And I started to build wealth. You know what I mean? I started to see that even though I really enjoyed these women's perspectives, that they were still 20 years older than me at that time. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I was looking for my Whitley Duane situation. I was looking for, like, you know, my post-college womanist. You know, I was a feminist. I was a womanist. I was just trying to live my life. And so I started to write a blog spot to kind of pick up where they left off to the 20-something-year-old that's like, yeah, that's good. No, y'all have partners, you have a lot more experience. What about us who are just out here trying to figure it out? And so I started to share, this is where I'm at, this is what I'm doing. And I started to also bring cultural pieces to it, like, you know, looking at the relationship between a lot of things that African Americans and Caribbean people do with money, and also how it stemmed from Africa. So I brought that cultural lens to it too. So I began to find not just the practical pieces around personal finance intriguing and actually helping me get better at seeing the numbers grow in my account, but the cultural, historical, and even like the beauty of how much we've been able to overcome and the creativity that we've had and using community as a part of our debt elimination plan. Made me very proud to be Black and made me very proud to build wealth because it became a Black thing, you know? And so that's the next steps that happened after I started to read.
So what are some of the cultural nuances that you'd say stood out the most to you? Let's just start with like specifically African-Americans and Caribbean folks.
So I would say that a lot of us think that Black people in America are overspenders, like that we only spend for clout, we spend for the gram and things like that. But historically, Black people have been great entrepreneurs, great wealth thinkers. And I think also they've used community to support each other in collective economics and cooperative economics. Mm-hmm. And so there's a system, I can't remember the exact name, but it's equivalent to what they call SUSU in the Caribbean, where a community comes together and they break down a pot of money. So we all contribute, say the pot is worth $10,000 and there's 10 of us. So each of us contribute $1,000 over like a 10-month period. And then we rotate the savings or we rotate the investment. And that was happening in the Geechee and the Gullah Islands, the same way it's happening in the Caribbean. And so in finding those connections, and then now I'm in Ghana and the name of SUSU is SUSU here, it's just a beautiful thing to see the continuity of that practice in the diaspora. And so it really helped me rethink, similar to finding Black female authors as my entry into the world of personal finance, stepping back and seeing that this has been a thing. We've been doing this for a while. It may not have been documented or shared, but just something like that I feel is important. Or even like rent parties, you know, that they used to have in Harlem. Those are things that folks in the Caribbean do as well. And just kind of smiling at the ingenuity of it all and how food and people come together to make money happen for us when we need it. So just things like that made me smile, and just thinking about what are some of the ways that we can, number one, honor this, share this information, but also replicate it if needed. And even like I used to start SUSUs at work or SUSUs with a couple of friends just to kind of keep the practice going so it wouldn't die.
We going to make some shit shake, baby. We going to figure it out. That's one thing across industries, finances, health, I don't know about health, but definitely finances, style, where there is lack, that ingenuity steps in.
Right.
We're going to figure some shit out.
Right.
Now, what are some of the limiting beliefs or what are some of the misconceptions that you think you had to kind of unearth or work through first before you are able to find yourself in a space where you were able to see some kind of progress in any of your financial decisions?
You know, I think that the irony for me was it happened later. So I was just following the plan. Like I had some type of belief in the books, like I could follow it, I'll work it. But it was only after I started to not have financial problems in terms of numbers, where I was actually in the green, that where all of my other triggers started to come up. So when I started to have more than enough, I started to feel like I didn't have enough. It was ironic. It was like when you're working towards something, you're highly motivated and you're almost blinded and kind of have blinders on. And then you wake up and you realize you're thinking your life is going to be different. And it is different, but not exactly in the ways that you think. So what it showed me was that getting out of debt was really important. And that's one part of it. Freeing your mind is the other part of the financial liberation. And so some of the beliefs that I had to get over ultimately were that it's safe to be generous, you know, based on all the things I have been taught earlier. I had to overcome this belief that there's more than enough. I had to overcome the belief that it's okay to take risks, because I grew up very risk averse. You know what I mean? Like get an education so you can get a job, but don't pursue your dreams because you may be poor and broke and, you know, and you'd be living helpless and hungry. Versus seeing that an education was just that, to teach you the skills and give you the critical thinking in order to figure things out that you might not have been able to figure out before, not just to get a job. And so I had to reconnect and rethink what my education was for. because from the typical maybe first gen family, and you get it, or you maybe you're the first to be in college in your family, they just want you to make it across the finish line. You know, it's like a win for everyone. It's a collective win. It's like when you're watching Jeopardy or, you know, Wheel of Fortune, when one of us wins and gets it right, then we're happy. When one of us doesn't get it right, we're embarrassed. You know, it's a collective embarrassment. And it's the same kind of thing, the fictive kinship. So I get it, but I do think that part of the growth came from realizing that I am Black, but Black people don't own me and don't own my thoughts, and being able to realize the ways in which those ways of thinking were helpful at that point to keep you safe. And also at that time in the 80s and 90s, it might have made sense. But I was also not Antiguan in the sense I was first generation American. I was born in America, and that is a different way of living. And I felt like it was, I had to learn that I get everything that the white boys get if I was born here, you know, versus just taking what you could get, when sometimes that's an immigrant mentality. Just be happy to be in the room, be grateful, versus like, no, I'm from here. I want a seat at that table. I'm going to go after it. I'm going to pursue my dreams like these white guys do, and then just kind of figure it out. So I had to overcome those fears, and I still have to overcome them a lot. But in terms of like the initial thinking about what are some of the things I had to realize, was that you can make mistakes with money and then you'll still be okay. Because a lot of times it was very final, similar to what you were saying, like, are you saving? Well, maybe I'm not saving that because I'm traveling, but I will be saving. Relax your soul. Do you know what I mean? It's not an either or. It's not either or. But because there's so much baked into maybe how others haven't been able to pursue their dreams, and their fear, and maybe they're trying to protect you, is more reflection of their beliefs than yours, but also because you care about them and maybe you still have a little bit of you that might believe what they believe, it just amplifies the doubt.
So I have a question for you. In terms of saving, right? Do you find that there are different ways to save? Because, for example, you can look at money like a whole picture, right? Or you can compartmentalize the way you think about money. There are different ways to do everything, right? But I'm considering, here's where I'm at now. There are, I personally, this might be the best way to give the example. I am best at saving when I specifically have something that I know I'm working for. The idea of me just putting money to the side just in case don't really work out for me, because just in case always happens before it should logically really be. And you know what I mean? Because like the adult me realizes that them sneakers I want to be in on sale isn't necessarily the just in case that it should have been. So there are the people that save because it's just their personal, they're good at it. Then you have those me, I need to see what I'm working for. And you'd mentioned to it earlier, when you had lack, when there was a goal, it was a lot easier to push and not do other things. But then you also have the people that are like, well, I can save for things that I can see more short term. I can save for a trip, but I can't necessarily see myself saving for retirement. I got another 45 years of working. Or I don't have any kids. Why am I saving for an education, like a college education? I already got my degree. Like, what am I doing? In terms of money and that big picture, do you see it more as like a larger, this is the overall, do all things the same? Or do you kind of see things, well, when you're working towards this, maybe take this approach? Or if this is what you're working on, consider using this methodology. Like, where do you kind of stand? Do you have a whole big picture, or do you have kind of smaller pockets that different things fit and match different ways?
I appreciate that. I would say that I was a financial hoarder. So I was like, you got $20, I can save $25, forget it. Do you know what I mean? Like, but so in working with different types of people, I learned that there are different ways that people interact with savings, right? So I think for people like you, Dee, maybe having an emotional connection to what it is that you're doing. So having like, I'm saving for a trip, you know, in 2025, and kind of feeling the people, the things you're going to do, the, you know, the kind of foolishness, the antics you're going to get into, kind of raises your vibration and makes you save more consistently. And also tends to make you save in larger amounts. There's lots of studies that show that we have to have an emotional connection to money. So if you know that you need an emotional connection to money, maybe a way that you can think about your older self is thinking about an older person that you care for. You know, would you want your grandma, you know, at Best Buy asking you, can I help you, you know, in 20, 30 years? Right? You smiling, but
that's a good fucking way to put it.
Right?
Sure. Never would have seen it that way.
She's leaning over and she can't hold up because she didn't think for 45 years that this is where she would be. So maybe having that picture of your grandma, or even sometimes even doing those kind of, you know, on TikTok or those kind of face things to see what you're going to look like when you get old. Sometimes it's hard to connect with your older self because you don't know. But if you actually begin to see the lines and the aging, then you're like, oh, this may be real. You may be able to connect with that experience more. So I think if you know you need an emotional connection, and habit is not enough, you need an emotional connection to what you do, those kinds of things may help you see, you know. Or for an example, if you're like, you know what, I need a healing fund. Because sometimes even naming it an emergency fund may not just, it may cause even more anxiety. But if you're in a season of healing and it's actually connected to your travel, it may encourage you and motivate you to save more because you know that this place in Costa Rica or wherever you're going to go is going to contribute to your healing. Or even I need to talk to a therapist, or I need to do some Reiki, or I need to do some, you know, whatever it is, it helps you contribute to that more. So when you, I think the idea is visualizing what you're looking towards long-term, like making sure grandma doesn't have to be at Best Buy, and no shade to Best Buy, but you get what I'm saying.
Yes.
And you know what I'm saying? And for those kind of short-term goals that maybe encourages you and motivates you to just put more and more often is to actually label what it's for, you know, and then kind of use the structures to help you continually stay excited about the savings process. Because I think sometimes the process of saving can feel like a downer if you're putting money that you wanted to spend on something else towards the savings. So I say, don't mix apples with oranges. If you have money that's meant to spend, spend it. If you have money that's meant to save, save it. And I think if you're able to compartmentalize that way, like I'm saving to spend, or I'm saving to save for X, Y, and Z. I'm saving for Grandma Moses, you know what I'm saying, for down the line. Then it makes it easy for you to emotionally connect, but then also be able to follow through with the actions.
I think also I've found the first step to me being able to save larger amounts was it had to be out of sight, out of mind.
Oh, for sure.
I had to be the one to physically take $100 from every paycheck and put it in another account, wasn't happening.
Yep.
As soon as I automated it through payroll, that a certain percentage of my check went to an account that I didn't even have an app for. It was one of them. I want to say it was actually a Black owned bank. I think it was like City National or City Industrial. I don't even know what the shit's called. That's my point. Like I just set it up, filled out the little HR paper for payroll, and it just goes there. And then you log in a year or a couple months later and you're like,
Right.
I bet we could do something with this.
And then
you got it. So I feel like if one way don't work, try out something else.
Sure.
What can you say was maybe the first tangible thing you did differently with money that you were able to see results with?
I would say, that's a good question because there's so many different things, but I would say tangibly, I remember reading a book during my deep kind of immersion phase. And I know you're not supposed to do it, but it felt good to me was to close all these credit card accounts that I had because they were just open for no reason. And I remember closing them and feeling so good. And then my credit took a hit a little bit, but then my credit score went up, you know? So I think that's not money in the bank per se, but it's my ability to change my financial landscape and that my credit score going up reduced my, made me a more attractive in terms of my ability to get positive interest rates and things like that. So I would say one thing. I would say another thing when it came to money was when I first started investing as a teacher. I went into a bank and I talked to this financial advisor. I think I was still in debt, But after reading all these books, I was just like, well, they said to invest. And all I got was like $25. Can you take this $25? And he, like my financial advisor, we've been together since like for like 20 years now. But he told me in hindsight that he didn't think I was coming back. Man, I came back with my little $25. I was like, I'm ready. You know, I sat down. I was like, what we doing? And then I started to automatically contribute until I could get out of debt. And then I started to add some more. And so that's another thing. And so another thing I did, last thing, is I remember being in grad school and getting back into debt after getting out of my first two degrees. And I was able to get a scholarship, a partial scholarship for grad school. And you still had to take out loans. And so what I did is I took the extra money and invested it. So the 2 years that I was in grad school, it grew. And so when they wanted money back, I could take it and give them extra. And I had some extra on the side. So I remember those kind of things feeling extremely powerful and feeling very smart about what I had been doing. But yeah, those are three big things that I did.
Okay. So you mentioned financial advisor, and you were still in debt, and you had $25 to the cause. What are your suggestions for someone finding a financial advisor? Like, how do you match that? Because I think with something as sensitive and as important to people as money, like personality matters. Like, I know me personally, if I, you know, didn't know any better, I could, you know, end up, I can see it going different ways, right? You choose somebody because you like them personally, but where are we going? What is my money doing, right? Or you choose somebody that's results, 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 stocks, 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 but they're not vibing with you. And so like, you're not connecting to the process, or you're not even engaged or interested in doing the things because this person's personality turns you off so much. So like, how, when do you suggest somebody like look or reach out to a financial advisor? Are financial advisors even trying to, you know, spend time with people who may only be able to like work with $100 a month? And then what exactly does like a financial advisor do? Is this the person that helps me get out of debt, or is this someone more that is just going to tell me how to work with different stocks? So like, how do we choose them? Like, when do we choose them? And then like, what do they do when we choose them? Or are there different types of financial advisors to choose from?
Sure. So I'll start with a financial advisor is someone who helps you with in your kind of your investment, like your money growth piece, versus someone helping you get out of debt. That's probably more of a money coach. So say someone like, I don't do coaching as much as I used to, but it'll be someone that may be well-versed in like financial foundations, like budgeting, debt elimination, credit cards, credit repair. And they probably sit with you a couple of times over the course of a certain amount of time, and then walk you through what you're doing and things like that. Financial advisors don't do that in general. They may say, get out of debt, and that's your plan. But you want maybe a financial coach that can do that. That's also also going to be an accountability partner. And they don't have to be the same thing, but that might be helpful. So an accountability partner could be a financial coach, but it could also just be someone in your network that's very a couple steps ahead of you, or someone who's equally motivated like you to get out of debt, and you guys meet over time to keep each other accountable for the things that you set as goals on a weekly basis, monthly basis, and a longer term basis.
Okay. So once you started working with your financial advisor, and once you started feeling, you know, a bit better with money, what was the first big thing you did? Like, what did you look to do with your money once you had it?
Well, I mean, I think that I wanted to make more money to invest more money for a while, but then I started to live a little. Honestly, I started to have more hope in terms of my finances, that I don't have to save every little thing. I didn't have to invest all the extra, which was growth for me as a person that was taught that you have to hold on to everything. So I started to live a little, and I would, of course, meet some of my financial goals first, but then I would travel. I mean, I would spend, especially as a teacher, I would spend summers in Costa Rica and Panama, learning Spanish and dancing salsa and just really enjoying my life. And I also, before that, But I lived in the Dominican Republic for a year. Okay. And so travel was a key part of just my value system, that I knew that deep down, that I knew money wasn't everything, though it was important, but sometimes you have to do first things first in order to take care of things, in order for you to have the ability to do what you want to do without the sense of guilt or sense of, you know, you don't want to go back and say, wow, I should have done X, Y, and Z. So that's what I did. And I created a plan of like consistently budgeting, consistently investing, staying out of debt. And I think by that time I might've gotten married, and my marriage was like very cost effective. We did it in my mom's house because I think he lost his job or I hated my job. It was one of the two at that time. So we knew that we didn't want, we knew there was going to be a financial change soon enough. So we wanted to make sure that that was taken care of. And I mean, I just continued also to build the Frugal Feminista. Once I got out of debt and I was starting to share my experience about, you know, being a Black woman, being a womanist, just trying to figure out life, it started to have some traction, and I started to see different ways to monetize the site. And I started to invest in like professional development. I went to conferences, things like that. In general, I've always considered myself a simple person, but I always invested in my well-being, travel being one of them. Mm-hmm. And even like go to therapy out of network. So that was costly, but I feel like I needed it. I made a connection with that particular therapist. I had food coaches, personal trainers. So I was just kind of investing in my wellness in general, because I wanted to, like I said, after I realized that money wasn't the issue, I realized I had to work on other aspects of my life. And then I used money to pay for those things, because now I had something that I wanted to achieve.
So when, I think another part about money and travel that gets kind of left out of the conversation is what or how do you spend your money on your travels, right? So I feel like there's always the, you know, you can save this way to travel and you can pay this way to, you know, more cost effectively, or it's a better budget getting on a trip, like with Afterpay or put it on a card or using points and all those other kind of things, right? But when you shifted your, I guess the way money sat with you, like your feelings on money, your, when you worked on your relationship with money, did you see that change at all in the way you actually spent your money after you'd already like achieved some of the goals to get it, right? Because plenty of us can save money to get on a trip, but then when we get on the trip, are we scared to spend money when we get there? Right. Or now are we like not doing certain things, thinking that one way or another, there's a lack, or I could, did so much to get here. What did that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends. Like, I think in general, my perspective on the world is I'm a little bit of a tree hugger when it's like, I don't want to, you know, mess up the environment. So, but I will do, in the same vein, you do see Fashion Nova in my closet, so I'm not going to pretend that it's not there. But I try to be conscious of like some of my consumerism. So I may not buy clothes to go on a trip, not because I'm trying to hold on to money, but you didn't see it, no one saw it. It's new to you, it's new to me, I'm wearing it, right? So it's more of those kinds of things. But like say like on a trip to like Ghana, I wanted to be comfortable. So I think about, I may not get the coach seat. I may get comfort, or I may get first class because it's a long flight. So right. I budget things like that. So I think about my comfort now. Like I'm getting older, and more importantly, long flights, I want to feel fresh when I get to my destination. And sometimes being in uncomfortable seats keeps you in that space of being jet lagged for longer. So I think about that. Like those are the kind of ways that I think about. Also think about like, you know, hotels. Like if I'm going to stay at a hotel, it has to be a nice hotel. I won't skimp on a hotel. It doesn't have to be the best room in the whole place, but it has to be a nice space, you know? So I would say, and I also do things that I want to do when I go to the places that I want to go. Like when I was in Panama, like I took salsa lessons because I really wanted to learn salsa. I took Spanish lessons because I wanted to, you know, get better at my speaking and reading. And so I tend to have a few things I want to go deep into when I go to a place. Even when I went to London, I brought the book, The Lonely Londoners, so I can read the book and kind of do some of the things that some of the characters did. So sometimes I could just be really nerdy and nerd out in some of my things, so that may not be expensive, but I tend not to deprive myself of the experience because I'm not going to be there again. But I'm also very mindful that I don't have to do the touristy thing or the things for the gram, because usually when I go to a place, it's usually because I have some type of connection to it, like something I've read in history or an author that I love. But, oh, wow, they did this thing. So I tend not to skimp on the experience. And sometimes, too, like, when I do go to a place, I do like to sometimes get like a nice piece of fill in the blank. It could be a piece of jewelry, or if that country is known for its leather, you may want to get like a nice leather bag. Right. So like maybe one nice kind of staple from the country that you can use over and over and over again. I allow myself that. So there is budgets because it's reasonable, but it's not restrictive just to say you got there and then you don't get to do anything.
Right. So what does your travel look like now? Like, where are you located? How do you move about with your travels? And what does your, like, not in your personal business, but like in terms of how you shape and move your money, like what decisions are you now making to kind of accommodate for travel? And I know that you are not necessarily on the same continent that I am on. Yeah. So expand on that and like where you are now, how is money viewed differently there?
So I'm in Ghana now, and I've been here for the past like 6 or 7 months. I can't say I've traveled much on the continent. Like, I haven't traveled at all on the continent because I've just been getting settled, but I have traveled back to the States. But what I will say is, based on the conversations I've had with people who are very much into traveling within the continent, it can be quite costly to travel from country to country on the continent than it is to travel from, say, a country in the continent to like Europe. So I have to, if I'm going to decide that I'm going to travel, my first steps in traveling in Ghana is to travel within Ghana. So there's some waterfalls that I really want to go to. There are some art spots that I really want to go to. And I want to take like cooking classes. So I'm still new to Ghana. So I feel like Ghana is like a treasure trove of experiences that don't require me to go to Nigeria or Togo yet. That I feel like I haven't even gotten a chance to experience Ghana. I'm in Accra, and there's so many other regions that are known for its eco beauty or for, you know, something else that I really don't know much about. So I would say that my travel is to be determined now that I'm getting settled, just like figure out my basics. Like my travel before, a lot of the first 6 months was like, where am I going to get my nails done? Where am I going to get my, you know, where's my latte? Like local stuff, like real
right,
local.
Right.
But then now it's like, okay, now that I feel like I have like my basic needs met and it's a sense of familiarity and routine, now I can really see the beauty of Ghana. Because I can't really say that I can report and say, these are all the things. Give me 6 more months, I can say, okay, these are the things that I enjoy. But waterfalls is one of the things I really want to experience.
Why Ghana?
So Ghana, my husband's Ghanaian, so that's one. So that's like an easy kind of like, you're Ghanaian. But then two, I studied in Ghana when I was in college. So I've always felt like I had a connection to Ghana. And it was before it became really sexy and, you know, Dirty December and stuff like that. But I also think too that honestly, years ago, so a couple things. One, Trump. So there were a lot of things that, you know, the racial reckoning, it was just too much. And being an educator and seeing, and I have a daughter who's very beautiful, nice and chocolatey, I knew that her life would be a lot more difficult trying to find the right educational fit for her, where she would be both loved and embraced and challenged academically. I felt there was either you be the brown one amongst white folk, or you be in a school where people look like you, but the expectations may not be high academically. And I couldn't afford a the third option, which would be, and I couldn't find any, to be quite honest, was like a third place where there was lots of brown people in a highly performing academic place that was private. Like it was just, I just didn't have the money or I couldn't find the resources. And so I was like, I want her to have a full experience as a person, not just a black girl in training where she has to fight her whole life, you know? And so I don't want her to be like, I just didn't want that for her. So in thinking about our options, the Frugal Feminista was growing. I was a school vice principal and I love middle school and I love my girls. It was a mixed school. It was a co-ed school, but I really took to a few girls and I got them scholarships. I got them into a few like the high performing schools. And I was like, my legacy is set. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. They got my phone number. They can call me. You know, I even saw one on the bus when I was back in New York. I'm good. Do you know what I mean? It's time for me to take a chance. And so all those things combined, Ghana, you know, and we have been thinking about it for a couple of years. And so we were like, well, if we don't get off this bus, we never gonna get off this bus if we don't try now. So there's no guarantee we'll stay forever, but we're, you know, shooting our shot and seeing what happens.
So what was that financial shift like? I don't know if you heard about it, but I know there was this story on Twitter, and forgive me on the details, y'all, but I want to say it was a Russian family, or no, it was a family. Don't know where they're from. They sold all their shit and they put their money, if I'm remembering these people's business appropriately, and sent it to Russia because they felt like that was going to be the, it was some racist shit essentially. So fuck them. Right. But they sent it there and was just like, yeah, we won't have the problems here, there. Turns out Russia wasn't with the shits. They was like, so who does this? Freeze. So all their money was frozen, right? And so now they were there, visas is fucked up. They got to figure something out, but you ain't got no money. So you got to leave to try to come back, but so mess, right? Mess. What financial considerations did you have to really put into the front of mind, or what would you suggest people kind of consider before they decide to up and leave? Because I know there's a, especially for those of us here in the travel shit world, America is not feeling like the best place to live. So a lot of us have danced around the idea of moving, like the idea is there, but the actual process of moving specifically with money, what was that process like? Did you have to establish income in Ghana first? Did you have to do the bank accounts? Was there something you had to call and email? Do you notify people? Sure. What is the money part of it looking like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Ghana in particular, I can only speak for Ghana. If you think about housing, so in Ghana, you have to pay for your housing in a year in advance. So you know how we do month to month in the States and you sign a lease and it's month to month? No. They want like the whole year's rent up front. And so I knew that I didn't want to do that. I was like, well, let's just get a house. And so we bought a house, but you need a lawyer. You need someone that's going to help figure out if there's a lot of scams and also cultural pieces of, say a family member, wants to sell you the house, but he didn't get consensus from the other family members. So he could technically take your money, but the house won't belong to you because everybody else in them said, this is still our house. So you need a lawyer on the ground to make sure that the house hasn't been sold 3, 4, 5 times over. Mm. So you can actually have ownership. And we had to go through 3 different homes to make sure with the support of a lawyer to make sure, that the house was ours. The house would be, the deed and all the things would be turned over. And that's a pretty lengthy process. So I would suggest that you come visit first, you know, and see if you can establish relationships. And I think even if you can't establish relationships like friendly ones where you can get word of mouth, I think looking for reputable legal spots or legal institutions in Ghana to help with the moving of African Americans to the continent and getting those kind of referrals and kind of doing a deep dive yourself, that might be the first step just to figure it out. And then actually coming to visit and say, okay, is what is being said actually happening? Because there's lots of online, on Instagram, like people who are doing lots of real estate on the continent. And some of them are, say, Ghanaians who've lived in the States, so they have more of a connection to African Americans and understand what they're looking for. But even that has to be vetted. So I would say first is just make sure you visit, and then kind of, if you're going to go through some type of agency, vet them and making sure there's a lawyer that can help you kind of get through the process. So that's just one. I would say two, determine your sources of income. So one of the things about moving was I enjoyed my government job, right? Like I was just like, this was steady, you know, it wasn't going to go away. And so I knew in my heart that in order for me to leave, even though I wanted to leave, it was almost like you had to kick me out of, you know, the school in order for me to leave, but I knew it was the right thing. I had to save up enough money that I felt would be comfortable for me. Mm-hmm. So I eliminated any extra debt that I had, and I started to beef up my saving. But also I told myself that I wanted to have enough money to invest as if I was still had the full-time job. So I save up enough money where I, even when I'm in Ghana, that I could still, I continue to invest the way I did. And I reduced it a little bit just so I could extend it some more. But those kinds of things, like how much do I invest on a yearly basis? So basically knowing your numbers, like how much do you want to invest by the end of the year? How much do you want to have in retirement? And then kind of backwards plan to figure out how long it will take you to get there. And if you need to accelerate it, accelerate it if you have a date that you're going to leave for, you know, relocating. And I would say in terms of four, especially if you're going to a country like, say, like Ghana, who you really have to bring your own infrastructure. I would say kind of looking at the cost of living. So Ghana.
What do you mean by that?
So the exchange rate for Ghana is $1 to 13 CDs now at the time of our reporting. And in a lot of ways, labor is extremely inexpensive from an American perspective, I should say. So we're able to have a driver, a cook, and someone come clean the house for less than like maybe $500 for the month, right? Okay. So there's that. But on the other hand, you know, there are a lot of things that can be expensive. Like if you don't want to go to like the local market, something like a Costco may not be equivalent in dollars, but close enough in dollars where your money can go faster. So if you're thinking you're moving to save money, you may save in some places for labor, but you may pay for products, especially since a lot of those things may be imported, right? So I think that getting comfortable with going to local markets, and they still may charge you more because they hear your accent and you're foreign, but it won't be as much. You can negotiate more than if you can just get the set price in like a store. Mm-hmm. So I would think about that. And I also think about bringing your own infrastructure. And what I mean by that is lights go out often. And if you have an online business, which I'll get to as like my next point, you don't want your money being messed up. Right. Yeah. Especially if you're still interfacing with the U.S. and that's like your reputation, that's your money. So thinking about solar panels, which can be expensive, or a generator. So when the lights do go out, and you can still have some electricity, especially you don't want to be caught up. Like, say we're in the middle of an interview and things just go, because lights went out tonight. But I didn't know because we have panels, solar panels. But that took 6 months to come, or 6 to 8 months to come, and a couple of tweaks to install. So I would say, depending on your budget, you need to know those numbers. And I'll say, finally, your sources of income. So going to a country where there may not be many opportunities to make US dollars, and that's really important to me, because ultimately, I don't know if we're going to go back. And so I'm a money person. So I'm like, okay, well, let me just keep, the Frugal Feminista has grown. So let me just continue to interface with the US as my clientele. Versus, like I said, $1 is 13 CDs. That means I have to work 13 times as hard to get $1. We're not doing that. So before you come, think about what income will you be able to have? Because if the place that you're going to is, number one, a currency that is not as strong as the currency you're coming from, and then two, the job market isn't that strong, the social services that we have grown accustomed to in the States are not always present in other countries. So in a lot of those ways, you have to kind of use community networks or your own stuff to make that happen.
So do you still like bank with American banks, or do you have mm-hmm. a Ghanaian bank, or how do mm-hmm. like, how do you, okay. Like, how do you so move
I'm
your finances?
So I'm in the process. Yeah. So I'm in the process of figuring out my banking system, but, what I do is unfreeze like my debit cards. I unfreeze, you have like a travel, like you have up to 3 months to kind of like tell them that you're in another country. So far what I do is I use my debit card. I take out like a large amount of money at a particular time, and then I exchange it at a Forex place and just kind of do cash like that. Another thing that I do when I come to the States, I take out as much money that's legal to come with, and I kind of use it as is. And because, and there's another thing called Momo, which is like mobile money, where say like I sell books or sell something like, or get paid in CDs, they pay me in my mobile money. And it's basically a wallet. So I can use that. It's like mm-hmm. Apple Pay or, yeah. And you can just use that as needed. So, sometimes it benefits me to say someone wants to do like some business consulting with me and I'm charging them CDs. Because it just works out that way. They just pay me mobile money and I just kind of use it to, you know, my regular spending. Yeah. So, but when it comes to like our mortgage and stuff like that, we had a loan from the bank here and it kind of gets deducted from there. So we do have a bank here, but it's specifically just for, banks for, the mortgage. But we kept our place in New York. And so our monthly withdrawals, we still have our American accounts that get their withdrawals every month on schedule the same way it was. And we just make sure that the money is there. So it's one big thing here, though, I'm still trying to figure out is the exchange of money can come with a lot of fees. I haven't experienced that yet because I haven't had to exchange a lot of money because of the things I just mentioned. But those are things I'm still working on, trying to figure out.
What did you do about your... I guess residency, citizenship, like, did you have mm-hmm. to navigate that at all? Or do you have just like a particular visa that lets you stay mm-hmm. there? Like, how did you work that mm-hmm. end of it out? What were your options, I guess?
So with Ghana, when you come, you're stamped for like 90 days or 60 days or something. And if you stay past that amount of time, you get like fined, but then that kicking you out. You just pay the fine. I have applied for my residency and it's a whole like day long process with papers and lawyers and things like that. And I've been able to get it. And it's the matter of getting a lawyer to help you through the process. Okay. But I think because I'm married to a Ghanaian, it's been an easier process. But in general, people get there. I'm not a citizen, but I have residency. So I'm not a citizen yet and I can't vote. But first step first is that I'm a resident, so I don't get the fine or, you know, mm-hmm. people trying to not kick me out, but like, I'm not here when I'm not supposed to be here.
And, it said, see you later. What was the question? In terms of buying the house, did you have to work out residency before you purchased property or because your husband is, a citizen, he didn't? Okay.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be the expert on how do you buy it. I know the parts about what you shouldn't do because we had to go through that process. Mm-hmm. But there are, like I said, places where Americans are coming in droves and even creating like African-American communities, which is an interesting kind mm-hmm. of take on gated communities on the continent. So they're creating their own little communities here through African-Americans who are building relationships with Ghanaians and creating these real estate developments. So we out here and there's like, you know, mixed ideas about what that means for a community, but it's probably a lot more streamlined than it was maybe 10, 15 years ago because Ghana has now become kind of been put on the map for African-Americans as a destination that will be safe. You know, that will be inviting and that'll be cost effective.
Okay. So where can the people find you, and what types of types of offers do you have available?
So you can find me on Instagram. I'm Frugal Feminista. You can find me on LinkedIn, Kara Stevens. And the offers, I have a few offers. One, I have the book, Heal Your Relationship with Money. So if you are kind of in this conversation trying to figure out your finances and want a place to kind of talk about your emotions, and you feel you have a little bit of financial trauma, avoidance, anger, resentment, just a lot of feelings around money that's holding you back from either travel or holding you back from just kind of moving forward in your life, I think that'd be the first step to take to read that book. And I have courses, Heal Your Relationship with Money. But my biggest piece too is I'm going to be launching soon a cohort experience called the Debt Free Society. And that is where you'll get group coaching with me. And we'll have a set curriculum on getting out of debt. But most importantly is healing your relationship with your debt story. Because a lot of us who are in debt hold a lot of shame. And similar to your relationship with money, but in particular your relationship with debt, it really, you know, drags you longer into the world of debt than it has to because of the emotions. And so I realized this was a big piece for a lot of women of color, specifically Black women who say want to travel but feel guilty because they have debt. But let's figure out how you can do both, because life is short and you do have to get, and it's best if you get out of debt. So how can we travel and still get you out of debt? It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. And so I'm really excited to be launching that soon. I'm doing the finishing touches on that. And you can always sign up for my newsletter. I'll leave you the link, D, so you can sign up. And you also get the first 3 days of Heal Your Relationship with Money for free. So you can get a taste of it if you want it. Yeah, so I believe that what I do, I think healing is a vehicle. For wealth, and probably similar, you think travel is a vehicle for healing as well. And I think it's important that there's representation of so many of us living well, you know, in our own definition of that and having the money to support it.
I really love that. Travel is so much more than vacation. And I love having those conversations about this every week. And finances are more than debt. Finances are saving. Finances are spending. There are a lot of different little pockets with which to look at it. And I find the same way I found my pocket and my lens of looking through travel. If you find your lens and looking through finances, you find your way a lot easier. Kara, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me this week. I absolutely appreciate chatting with you. And to all of y'all, we will see you next week.